All right, welcome to another episode of ICU Doc Talk. Today I'm going to talk about what it's like to have children. And I'm not joking. Like having children and maybe going into being a healthcare worker and having a demanding job or not, just kind of, you know, my experience. And I'm going to talk about some child development books that I've really enjoyed as well. So let's do it. And this episode is intended for people that have children to relate with, but also people that don't have children, that never intended having children, or maybe are thinking about having children. I intend it for all people, regardless of review. So if what I always say about having, so I have one child, I have one, just one, I have a toddler, and she's absolutely amazing. I love her to death. She is the greatest source of joy in my life, the most rewarding thing that has ever happened to me, easily by far. And also having a child is one of the hardest things I've ever done in my entire life. Pretty easily. And one thing I like to say is that the decision to have children you cannot have an informed consent when deciding to have a child. Meaning, it doesn't matter how someone like me or someone in your life tells you what it's like to have children. You have absolutely no idea what it's like before you decide to do it. And you just take the plunge, and then suddenly you have a child. It's not, you cannot, that's why you can't be very well informed. Hey, here's what it's like to have a child. You know, like you go into surgery and you get informed of all the risks and benefits and stuff. And you're like, okay. And that's informed consent. There is no informed consent with having a child. You just take the plunge and it just happens to you like a hurricane. So me and my wife wanted to have children for several years, and we went through the process. Two miscarriages before that. And that's a whole nother topic, talking about miscarriages. Having a miscarriage is a unique form of grief. There's nothing like having a miscarriage. And I feel like people need to talk more about having a miscarriage, because it's so extremely common. If you've had a miscarriage, you know that when you talk to people about it, they're like, oh yeah, I had that. It happened to us, happened to me. It's extremely common, and it needs to be, the grief for it should be normal. It's not, you know, it's the loss of a potential child. It's its own unique form of grief, and it needs to be grieved. So because of that, because we had two miscarriages prior, when my wife was pregnant with my current daughter, I didn't celebrate. I didn't want to feel attached to her until she was in my arms. You know what I mean? So I was very guarded because of that experience of having miscarriages. So we had quite a journey until we had our daughter. And I always thought that before my daughter was born, I was like, oh yeah, so it's going to be, you know, it'll be hard. And I'm like, oh yeah, there'll be sleepless nights and things like that. And I was like, well, I'm used to sleepless nights, right? I'm in medicine. I do call all the time. I've gone through residency in medical school. I know what sleep deprivation is, right? So if you're a parent, you are probably laughing along with me. So the sleep deprivation of having a child, a newborn and a baby does not compare to like having call on your job, you know, being sleep deprivation. The reason is there's no post-call date. You don't make up that sleep. You don't make it up. You're just now a sleep deprived human being. Like there's not, it doesn't, I was extremely naive thinking that I could handle that like, oh, I got this, you know, it was like nothing I've ever experienced. The sleep deprivation and exhaustion is like nothing I've ever experienced. So that just that's just goes along with my thing. There is no informed consent. You just do it. Another thing I've realized since having a child is before I had a child, I thought there was these different chapters in your life, like in the typical, you know, kind of privileged American life, which I live, right? I was born to middle class and parents, and I thought, you know, there's different chapters. Like you have childhood and adolescence, and then you know high school, and then you go to college, and there's a closing of that chapter and a beginning of a new chapter, and now you know in college, I'm now in med school. That's a new chapter. So there's only two after having a child. I realized there's only two chapters in your life: the chapter before you had a child and the chapter after you had a child, because your life fundamentally changes. Fundamentally, it'll never go back to being how it was. And I'm mostly giving this advice for if you don't have a child, it will never go back to what you think it was. So you will, there's almost some of the things that you can struggle with when you have a child is this, you know, loss of your identity and loss of identity with your partner, if you have one, loss of that relationship, and that you can feel that. And what I've learned is it's, you do have certain losses of certain aspects of your life, but they mature and they change into something new, and you need to embrace the transformation that occurs, that undoubtedly occurs. You cannot stop the transformation of how your life is going to change and how it transforms. You cannot stop it. You must go with the flow and embrace it. And then what you find is it's something, in my experience, is something far greater than what you had before as a whole. the loss of leisure time and things like that, which, you know, leisure time and all those things are extremely important, and you totally lose those things, right? But you after having a child, those things they're meaningless. You realize how, like for me, they're just, they had no meaning. And so I don't even know what I'm trying to say. I'm just getting a little lost, but the meaning and the transformation that occurs in your life, you have to embrace it. If you try to cling to that identity and what you were before, you'll face a lot of probably depression, and you know, you'll really, really struggle. And I think, and the transformation is hard. It's a struggle for everybody, I think. That transformation into parenthood, into being a parent, is difficult. It's difficult, but it's amazing. I gotta say, it's just amazing. And the growth that you will not grow as much as you do grow as you become a parent. You'll just grow so much as a person. You'll understand that you're not as patient as you thought you were, and that, oh, wow, maybe you do have a little bit of an anger problem that you didn't know that you had, and it starts to encourage, you know, these weaknesses and frailties in your personality that maybe you didn't even know were there, they start to come out, and you explore them, and how you adapt and respond to them, I think, is really extremely important. Now, I want to touch on what it is to be in our society, what it is to be a dad, specifically a dad, being like a man as a parent. So I'll just say this, just to start this off. Men, and I'm generalizing here, but I think my generalizations are accurate, and they're mostly true. I think they're broadly true with what I'm about to talk about. There's obviously exceptions all over the place, but I think mostly my generalizations are totally true. And here's my first generalization. Men are very, very poorly prepared to be good parents. Our society does not instill in men the values to be a parent. It's not a skill that's valued in us. So we're not raised to be parents. Men are not, this is my generalization, men in our Western society, and probably most societies, are not raised to be parents. We are not given those skills. We are ill-equipped to run a household and to be parents. And it's going to sound like I'm being like an apologetic for men right here, but I'm not. What I just to flesh this out a little bit more, let's just take a stereotypical heterosexual, and most of my conversation here obviously is heteronormative, right? I'm mostly, because that's my experience, right? I'm heteronormative, I'm married to a woman, I'm a man, et cetera, and we have a child. We're very typical in that, right? Obviously, there's many scenarios that are not like this. But so, but I'm mostly speaking from my experience. So, what was I saying? Men are absolutely, so like, let's say there's a couple and a baby is born right at that moment. That on average, the in this heteronormative couple, the mother is light years ahead of the man or the father in being a parent. Light years, immediately. We are so, men are so, so far behind in what it even means to be a parent, a caregiver, and to run a home with a child in it. We are woefully behind and unprepared on average. I know I was. I'm speaking from my own experience. So let's just pause for, let's just think about boys and girls, like children. Let's think about what their play is like and how they're, like the values that are instilled in them. Okay. So on, again, these are all, I'll just say it one more time. I'm making generalizations here. I think they're broadly accurate, but there's exceptions. Okay. That's the last waiver I'll give. That's for the rest of this podcast. So, you know, boys and girls at recess, what are they doing? They're often doing different things. And this isn't the nature, I'm getting into the weeds here, but I want to. I'm talking, you know, gender and sex. So in my opinion, gender is a social construct, meaning we are socialized into a gender. I do not think there are inherently, I don't think men and women have inherent skills. I think they're imbued to us by society as we're born and raised. We're raised into gender expectations. And then those color our personalities and our attitudes and things like that. So gender is socialized. Sex, and I'm not going to talk about transgender stuff because I'm not very well read about it. But you know, in my opinion, expert opinion. So sex obviously is an anatomical thing. Sex is also on a spectrum. It's not binary, right? There are XX chromosome people. There are XY chromosome people. There are people born with XO. Different chromosomes. So sex is not binary. That's a fact. It's a scientific fact, right? So there are not just two sexes. And that it's not, I'm not just like coming up with, this isn't just liberal nonsense. That's a fact. There are more than one sex genetically, like that, right? And, you know, the secondary sexual traits and all that stuff. But let me organize my thoughts. So sex, there's anatomical sex, and that is like a fact. It's like a biological fact. Someone is sexually a female or sexually a male, or they can be hermaphroditic, or they can have different sexual traits. So that's one thing. But then gender is another thing, right? Gender is how is male female gender expectations that are placed on a person, and we are trained, we are indoctrinated by our society, we are socialized to behave as a gender, and then that's how we get gender differences that are manifested. And then people think that that's an inherent quality of the sex. And I do not believe it is. I believe it is a gender socialization, if that makes any sense. So like, if you think of the stereotypes of men and women, you know, women, oh, they're nurturing and they're kind and more than men, and men are stoic and things like that. Well, that often is very true. That generalization and that stereotype is often true. Now, I do not believe it's true because of inherent sexual traits. I think it's true because those values and skills are engendered at birth for them to be like that. So it's weird. It's like this chicken and egg thing, right? I do think on average, these gender traits that we stereotype genders with are often true. They're observable. But I believe that they are instilled in us at an early age from gender socialization, if that makes any sense. Okay, so what is my point? So let's back it up. So men and boys and girls, right? How are they playing? Yeah, they play the same, but oftentimes the value, the things that we say that they learn, that children, they will behave and think in a way that they know society values that behavior in them, right? So you have boys that are, you know, act, you know, their play is like whatever. Maybe it's more physical. Although I know girls play physical as well. Here's my point: who is focused on relationships and things like that at a young age between their peers? And who is oblivious to relationships? Which gender on average, right? It's usually boys and teenage boys and adolescent boys that are oblivious to gender relationship dynamics. And women, girls, are acutely aware of relationship dynamics within social groups. Acutely aware of those things, if that makes any sense. There's a lot more I think I could go into, but my point is, from a young age, girls and boys start acting different because they will do those things that give them the praise and they will fall within the way that they are socialized, the socialized expectations of their gender. Ugh, I know I'm saying a lot here. I hope I'm making sense. My point with bringing all this up is the way that we are socialized as between boy and girl manifests later as adults, and thus continues the cycle of gender socialization. I think that's the genesis of why men, fathers, when they become parents, are extremely far behind. And here's what I'm really getting to. I'm talking about emotional intelligence here, okay? In my opinion, women on average have higher emotional intelligence than men. I don't think that's a outrageous claim. I think many, many would agree with me. And just to reiterate my point, I do not believe that is because women inherently, because of their sex, have more emotional intelligence. I believe it is they've developed it more than men are because it's more valued in them than it's valued in men. That is what I'm trying to say with all that. And I fully recognize that this is just my opinion, right? And it's an unexpert opinion, and it's highly debatable what I'm talking about. So, and as lots of my opinions, I'm very open to being debate and being convinced out of this, right? Opinions about gender and stuff are changing constantly with cultural zeitgeist. And I, you know, my opinions change right along with that. There's nothing special about my opinions, but I realize this is highly debatable. The things that I, you know, just that I'm talking about here. But my main point, just this last few minutes, is that men on average are not very well prepared to be caretakers because it is a skill that is not instilled in us. And we often lack the emotional intelligence to help to raise children appropriately. It's something that I've observed many times, and it's probably something I bet you have observed as well, to you that is listening to this. And now this, this dichotomy between men and women, you know, fathers and mothers, and how we're set up to be, I think men are often set up for failure to be emotionally available people, parents to their children. Now this harms everybody, this harms men. It harms the relationship with their children. It's just a terrible, this gender labored, this gender labor division we have amongst parents. It harms everybody. And all, this is all complex, and it's all related to patriarchy and all of that big ball of wax as well. And so one thing I've noticed is that, as a dad, a fairly new dad, there's no like support system of dads other than one of my good friends, who really helped me, who was a dad, before me, that kind of helped me, kind of mentored me a lot before having our child. But there's not like, when there's a new mother, there's an entire network of a socialized network in place of mothers and prior mothers and caregivers and all that stuff, prior mothers that had young children, that's there to support. And men are like isolated right away, like in their dadhood and their parenthood. Like they're like on this island groping and trying to figure out, and often failing a lot and being a source of frustration to their wives, to their partners that are, women. And it's just, again, I'm not, it sounds like I'm being an apologetic for men, but I'm not trying to be that way, but I'm just trying to men are set up to fail as parents. Because what are the values that are instilled in us from a young age, right? Success, whatever that looks like, making money, physical dominance, physical prowess, and then stoicism, not embracing emotions, right? Not embracing the spectrum of emotions. There's only a couple emotions that are valued in men, and that's like modern day, modernly, what are those emotions that are acceptable for men? Like, I guess anger. Maybe not acceptable. I mean, I should just say normalized, right? There's like anger, there's dominance, there's sarcasm, humor. What else, right? What else are we socialized to value in men, right? Now, these aren't the attributes that I think most women desire in men. I think most women desire in men the attributes of emotional intelligence. But we're just emotionally ill-equipped. And women are, it's more socially acceptable for them to display and show all of their emotions. The lack, I know I'm getting to the weeds here. The traditional thing is like, oh, if a man cries, that's a weakness, right? The fact that men don't cry is a sign of emotional weakness, that they hold, that they don't. Crying, expressing emotion, is emotional resiliency and having a good coping. Anyway, like, you know, good emotional coping. Now I'm going to get dark here for a moment, so just so you're aware, I'm about to go to a dark place of things that happen. It's very rarely women and mothers that snap and kill their entire families. Okay, it's men that do that, mostly. It's complicated why that happens. Domestic violence, and then, you know, murder, where men murder their entire family, including their children. I think there's many reasons that lead to that, but I think the lack of emotional resiliency and not being able to embrace their emotions, and I think all that starts as a child. And it's not just a parent's fault, but it's a society's fault. This is how men, the only way that they know how to have emotional catharsis is violence for many, many men. And sometimes that violence, they cannot handle it anymore. And that's a result that you get. And I think it's from gender socialization that happens at a young age. Anyway, I know I've said a lot here. I'm going to read, let me get to some books about parenting because I've gone to a dark place. You know, think about those thoughts. Email me if you have other thoughts. This is a very incomplete discussion, but we're going to get to some parenting books that'll give a little bit more structure to the topic today. Okay, the first book I'm going to briefly mention is by John Gottman, Dr. Jack Gottman, who's pretty famous for, you know, the Gottman Method with marriage counseling. And I've read his marriage book, which is very good. But I'm just going to briefly discuss Raising an Emotionally Intelligent Child, The Heart of Parenting. This is a really good book about preparing your child to not only understand their emotions, but to equip them for adulthood. The main premise of the book is to become an emotional coach to your children. And it's not really that complex of a thing to do. There are three types of non-emotional coaching parents that are not doing things, that are not emotionally available and helping their children. It is being dismissive, being disapproving, or laissez-faire. The dismissing and disapproving are obvious, right? They either, oh, don't cry, blah, or they dismiss it like, oh, it's not that big of a deal, right? But the laissez-faire parent who appears to respect their children's emotions by letting them explore, appears to like, hey, that's great. But the problem is they don't provide the guidance about what to do with their emotions. None of these parenting styles actually help children. And becoming an emotional coach is actually, you know, for your child, is really simple. Now, one of the hard things is doing it consistently, right, over years and years and years through parenthood. But it is simple. One of the main things you do is you just make observations about their emotional state with your child. Rather than dictating and interrogating children about their emotions, you offer observations, you validate their emotions, you empathize with them, and just be there for those moments. One thing I really liked is that he talked about creating green, yellow, and red zones of, you know, permissible behavior. Yellow zone is needed because it allows children to push some sort of boundary, knowing that the parent disapproves, but all it allows them to grow. If you're a parent, you should ask yourself, from where is your power derived over your child? If it's from your anger, or from humiliating your child, or from being far too permissive, these power sources will not help children grow and will likely teach them toxic coping methods. The power that you have over your child should be derived from the emotional trust you have with them, the bond that you have with them. That's your power over them, which is good. This is why simply being disappointed, you know, like, oh, I'm disappointed, that's a punishment in and of itself, because you have fostered a healthy emotional relationship with them prior that ensures how you feel about them matters to them. Here's the the simple but poignant point of this book. Children have reasons for their emotions, just like any adult. And just like any adult, you can observe, explore, and empathize rather than dismiss their emotions as the, like, incoherent emotions of a toddler or something. You see it, you know, on social media, TikTok or whatever. Excuse me. You'll see, like, you know, it's got millions of views, and it's like a child, a toddler who's having like a meltdown and breakdown, and they're like throwing things or they're crying in a funny way, and it's hilarious, right? And everybody laughs, and they're being filmed. It's like that for that child, they were having an emotional meltdown. Like, why are we making a spectacle of this? It's just weird. There's lots of weird things that I've been a parent that I'm just like, what? There's so much dismissive behavior I feel like one of the main parenting techniques that's pervasive is dismissing children's emotions. I just observe it all the time. I'm not saying I don't do it. I know I'm sounding like kind of sanctimonious, but it's like, oh no, it's fine. Oh, that doesn't matter. It's fine, but, you know, just like, ooh, the dismissal. And then another bad parenting method I've seen that's pervasive is distracting them from their emotions. Like, when they are having problems with it, something, distracting them away from it. And it might work in the short term, but that does not address their emotions. All right, and then the other book I wanted to mention about parenting, which is phenomenal, which you should read this. Like, if you're a parent, you should definitely read this book. It's called Good Inside, A Guide to Becoming the Parent You Want to Be by Becky Kennedy, who's a child psychologist. The take home from this book is that you and your child are good inside, no matter what. No matter what happens, you're good inside, your child is good inside. So this is definitely one of the best parenting books I've ever read. So her approach and methodology to parenting is one of compassion and understanding and patience and engagement. From this book, I feel like I've learned three key things that all children seek. Three things. They seek connection to you as their parent. They seek bodily autonomy. They want to do their own thing with their own bodies and their environment. And then they also seek boundaries. Most conflicts arise, I think, when one of these three needs are not met. Now, I'm oversimplifying, obviously. There's so many nuggets of good advice here that they all cohere with a grand strategy of recognizing that behaviors are not your child. They are windows into their needs. By focusing and obsessing about behavior modification, we impute that behavior onto our children's identity. In other words, our reactions to their transient behaviors get internalized into their identities, which can be extremely harmful and toxic and can last well into their adulthood. The obsession with fixing their problems and focusing on happiness being the optimum state also ill prepares children to navigate their own emotions. If we shame away emotions of distress, this translates into adult anxiety, because we've created an adult who suddenly doesn't have someone to enforce happiness, right? Parents try to enforce happiness, and they can't achieve it themselves, so they are left with anxiety and dread and depression, all the things that go along with that. Connection with your child is always better than consequence. Foregoing punishment does not mean condoning a behavior. We are raising humans, not modifying behavior one sticker chart at a time. One thing she talks about a lot is always assume the most generous interpretation, or MGI, of a child's behavior. Whatever they're doing, assume what is the most generous interpretation for them. Know that they are still good inside, even though they just told you that they wish you were dead or whatever. Focusing on your child's impact on your emotional state as a parent, like, you know, being like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you said that. Why would you say that about your father? That sets them up for emotional codependency with you and not autonomous emotional regulation. The goal is to teach the skills of emotional regulation, a lesson that many adults also haven't learned yet. One thing she talks about is embracing the multiplicity of your roles as a parent. You can be fun and authoritative at the same time. You should be many things at once for your child. It's okay. Understanding when your child is having an unformulated experience, like, you know, listening to a vacuum for the first time and not knowing what it is, that's an unformulated experience, which can be scary. Scary for an adult too, an unformulated experience. You would never dismiss an adult's feelings of fear or anxiety. So why is that normalized to do this with a child? Their feelings and thoughts are just as real and go unregulated, meaning they're in even more need of compassion and connection constantly, even more so than an adult. Tantrums can actually be good because they teach children to advocate for themselves, which is an amazing perspective. They're just a tsunami of unregulated emotion, a tantrum. Containment is key during a tantrum, not engaging with logic. You contain and connect, and then talk once the tantrum has passed. You name the wish underneath the tantrum, which helps them immediately connect with you. You're like, oh, you know, that's really hard. I know you want that right now. I like that too, right? Then they feel connected with you. And one thing, one of her advice is to remember these words during an unsafe tantrum. Like say they're jumping on the bed or doing something unsafe. You say, I won't let you. And then you remove them physically because that gives them the boundaries that they actually may be seeking. Seeking fairness in a family dynamic actually could lead to problems when you try to make everything fair, which is something I've never heard before. When you focus on equality and not equity of need, you raise a bunch of like bean counters, a bunch of bean counting children that obsess about what their siblings have received. And you almost set them up for like a disimpassioned entitlement, right? Really interesting concept. Hesitation and shyness are not problems to fix, according to Dr. Kennedy. Shyness can actually be a sign of confidence, which I've never thought of it that way, as a child is feeling comfortable in their own skin enough to hang back or go against the crowd and just watch from a distance. And you should never use the words, oh, she's just being shy, because this labels her as a shy child, and that can cause an internalization of that as an identity. Minimizing anxiety around food is sometimes more important than the consumption of that food at that time. Give dessert alongside the meal to lower the stakes and take sweets down from the pedestal. I do this with my daughter, and it absolutely works. We give her dessert alongside her food, and she's like, great. She eats a little of that, and then she eats her food. And then sometimes she wants a little more dessert. We're like, no, we're done with dessert. And she's like, fine. And she just keeps eating her meal. It works. It's magic. It works really, really well. Another amazing thing is we have to teach children the brain circuitry of consent. If they don't want hugs from their grandparents or whatever, they shouldn't get hugs from their grandparents. No should always mean no, and not a joking yes. Very important. She talks about sleep separation anxiety. That should start, you know, trying to help with that should start with daytime separation anxiety and should be worked out during the day, not during nighttime. A great idea that which I plan on doing with my daughter is putting a picture of yourself next to their bed and a picture of them next to your bed to solidify that connection that they want at night, which is causing that sleep separation anxiety. You can do dry runs during the day of what a bedtime routine should look like. Basically, one of the main points is everyone needs to know their job in the family. And this is one of key points. A parent's job is to keep children safe and to set boundaries. It is not to dictate what emotions are okay and what emotions are not okay. That is not a parent's job. It's not your parent's job to say like, nope, you shouldn't be feeling sad. It's not your job. A child's job is to learn and explore emotions, not to dictate the boundaries. When these job descriptions get confused, that's when frustration and tantrums and all that stuff and everybody, that's when that follows. Just really, really, really amazing advice. I've only talked about a tiny fraction of this book. Definitely, the prior book by Gottman is good, but if you're going to read one of these two books, definitely read this book by Dr. Becky Kennedy called Good Inside, A Guide to Becoming the Parent You Want to Be. Phenomenal book. The last thing I want to say about parenting and I don't think, in my opinion, right, this is just my like non-medical opinion, because this entire podcast has been my non-medical opinion, it's just my own, you know, musings. Having children doesn't fix things, right? Having a child does not fix a marriage. If a marriage is in trouble and you use a child to fix it, that marriage will not only will it remain in trouble, but it'll get worse with a child. A child is the most challenging thing that has ever one of the most challenging things that can happen to a marriage. And I don't think everybody, so I'll just leave you this thought. I think having a child is amazing. I've already said it. It's the most amazing thing that's ever happened to me. The love I have for my daughter is bottomless, and it's a love I've never quite experienced before. And the absolute joy of watching her grow is indescribable. It is like nothing I've ever experienced in my life. It makes everything else pale. And anything else I've done in my life is just, it's nothing. It doesn't even matter. Now, having said all that, I don't think having children is for everybody. It's just not. It's not. It's not because I don't think people don't have what it takes, et cetera, et cetera. I don't think anybody should feel that they have to have a child. You should never be pressured by society or because you're a woman. If you feel pressured that way because you have a uterus and like, oh, I need to, you know, not everybody should have a child. And I don't think, I'll leave you with this one kind of maybe foreboding bit of advice. If you want to have a child, but right now but you're a little hesitant that you're not ready. Well, I was about to say then you shouldn't have a child, but then again, you're never ready because there is no informed consent. So I don't know what to say. I know I'm being confusing, but a child is not going to fix things that are bad in your life. But sometimes you just got to take that dive. I don't know. I know. Sorry. That's all I got. All right. So I'm going to end that conversation there. And let's go on. I'm going to answer just one question here. Okay. This is a... Let's see. Hang on. Sorry. The question is, do you have any suggestions about using TPA in a code? I'm sure I've talked about this before, but I'll just answer it. So TPA is a clot busting medication that it literally busts up blood clots, which is different from an anticoagulation like heparin or warfarin or rivaroxaban or something like that. Those medications prevent further clot from developing in someone who has already developed blood clots. TPA, tenecteplase, and there's other medications like it. They dissolve the clot quickly. So sometimes in a code blue, which is a cardiac arrest in the United States, can be caused by like something like a massive pulmonary embolism, which is a big clot that dislodges in your lungs or maybe even in the right side of your heart that prevents your heart from pumping and having forward flow, and that causes you to go into cardiac arrest. Here's the problem. So when you're, say someone goes into cardiac arrest and you're doing chest compressions, you don't always know. Often you do. It depends on the context, but you don't always know why that person is in cardiac arrest. And part of running a code blue is not only are you resuscitating the patient, but you're also continuously diagnosing and you're trying to kind of interrogate and you're trying to figure out what's going on. TPA is also a dangerous medication because it busts up clot. It can also cause bleeding. It can cause hemorrhaging that can in itself be harmful and maybe even fatal. So you have to be very careful with its use. So do I use TPA in a code blue in cardiac arrest? Yes, I have. Is it the first? Obviously it's not the first thing you're reaching for. You must arrive to that conclusion thoughtfully about using TPA. So in the context that I use it in a code is usually the resuscitation has started. We're doing chest compressions. We're doing our pulse checks every 2 minutes. We're doing rhythm checks. We're shocking if needed. We're not shocking, whatever it is. We're getting IV access. We're drawing off fluids. We're giving fluids. We're drawing labs. We're getting rapid labs at the bedside to show us what's going on. Maybe we're getting a hemoglobin. Maybe we're getting a lactate or a potassium to help, or you know, calcium, all these things to help kind of guide, what's going on. And then maybe I also put an ultrasound on their heart to see if that gives me more information. And as the code is going, if it's been 10 minutes, 20 minutes, and we're not having any, we're not getting the patient back. And then if they're at risk for a PE, pulmonary embolism, Like I start learning about their history. Oh, and they have a history of cancer. Well, that's high risk for PE. Or they have just they've just had osteopathic surgery, not osteopathic, orthopedic surgery on their bones. That's a high risk for pulmonary embolism. So as my index of suspicion raises and the code keeps going and they're not resuscitating, then I might be like, maybe this is a pulmonary embolism. Now, and then we would give it what we call empirically. When we give something empirically, it means we don't have total evidence yet, but our suspicion is high enough that we're going to give it. Right? Everything's a risk-benefit analysis, of course. Now, my only caveat with this is get a hemoglobin first or a hematocrit first before you give a tPA. Make sure they're not bleeding out. Say they're bleeding in their belly. Say, you know, you get a hemoglobin and it's, you know, 6. Well, don't give tPA because you're going to kill them more by giving them tPA because they're going to bleed out even more. So I guess to answer that question, the reason when I would give a tPA is if the code has been going on for a fairly good amount of time, 15, 20 minutes, we're not getting them back. There's nothing obvious. I don't know what has caused it. Maybe it's PEA arrest as well, pulmonary electrical activity. They have a normal hemoglobin. And then maybe they even have a history of PE. They're at a risk factor for it. Then under those circumstances, I may give tPA. And I have. I don't think anyone could blame me for giving tPA under those circumstances that I described. I'll wrap it up. As I've mentioned in my couple recent podcasts, I have a new book coming out. It's called Saint Elspeth. It's coming out November 4th. And if you would like, for my audience here, if you would like a free ebook of it, just email me and I'll just give it to you. Before the release date, you can read it. We'll say in the month, whatever. Just if you want to, just email me. I don't care. Just email it to me. I'll send it to you. At icudrecmo@gmail.com. Just email me and I'll give it to you. It's a sci-fi book. This is my sixth published novel. Imagine that a bunch of aliens show up in the sky and the world goes mad, right? And, oh man, I think I'm too tired to explain the plot right now. I gotta just end this. If you want the, just email me if you want the book. I gotta go. Thanks.